Besinnung auf archaische Symbole oder das goldene Zeitalter. Dass das beides allerdings fatale, totalitäre Regime sind, wo, ich meine, Millionen Menschen ihr Leben gelassen haben, wo auch Künstler unter extrem erschwerten Bedingungen arbeiten konnten oder auch ihr Leben lassen mussten, ist außer Frage. Aber hier besteht schon ein Unterschied.
Ja, aber schwierig ist vielleicht tatsächlich, dass, wie es Boris Groß gemacht hat, zu sagen, da gibt es dieser Hang, jeder kann ein Künstler werden, auch in diesen Formen der Darstellung. Weil was Stalin ja tatsächlich immer versucht hat, war, die aristokratische Gesellschaft zu kopieren in diesen Formen der...
Ich glaube, Stalin hat einen Personenkult rund um ihn eingeführt, der im Grunde untypisch war für den Kommunismus, also den man von Lenin nicht so gekannt hat, um sich halt quasi als legitimer Nachfolger sowohl von Lenin zu gerieren, als auch quasi des Zarenregimes, wenn man so möchte. Ich glaube, dass da eine Bilderfabrik genau natürlich in diese Richtung gearbeitet hat. Aber ich glaube, was die Ausstellung insbesondere zeigt, ist eben die Fassade, die rund um diesen Schrecken auch aufgebaut wurde und die quasi eine ungemein suggestive Kraft gehabt hat. Aber wir dekonstruieren ja auch im Grunde damit die Fassade. Und wir zeigen natürlich auch die Mittel der Propaganda, so wie wir sie in unserer Massenkultur heute permanent auch wieder treffen. Die Bilder aus dem letzten Irakkrieg sprechen Bände dafür, wie wir mit konstruierten Bilderwelten konfrontiert sind, wie wir einen George Bush in Armeeuniform auf seinem Flugzeugträger sehen, der sich quasi als neuen Erlöser gegen die Terrorregimes der Welt darstellt.
Okay, vielen Dank. Moment, warte. Hier an dieser Ausstellung.
Das Interesse ist sehr groß.
Was wollen Sie denn wissen, also wenn Sie jetzt diese Bilder auch erklären müssen, Stalin vor dem kommunistischen was wollen die da genau wissen?
Ich denke, dass die meisten Fragen von den russischen Journalisten haben sich bezogen an die Frage, wie sieht der neue Kontext der Rezeption dieser Arbeiten, des sozialistischen Realismus der Steinzeit aus. Ja? Das heißt, wie ich diesen Kontext sehe, welchen Kontext setze ich voraus, ja, wenn ich diese Ausstellung mache. Und ob diese Voraussetzungen sich erfüllt haben. Also ich glaube, die Frage nach dem Kontext der Rezeption, das ist die zentrale Frage.
Okay. Also dann ist natürlich schwierig, wenn Sie dann wiederum Beuys und jeder kann ein Künstler werden, als Beispiel nehmen, wenn man weiß, dass Stalin eigentlich immer versucht hat, die aristokratische Gesellschaft zu kopieren, also die russische aristokratische Gesellschaft.
Und das würde ich allerdings nicht behaupten, ja.
Geht es dann auch wirklich um Künstler, also oder dass jeder ein Künstler
ist? Es geht darum, dass Stalin als Politiker hat Bilder produziert, wie jeder Politiker es heute tut, unter den Bedingungen der Massenkultur und hat auch daran teilgenommen, diese Bilder zu gestalten und so weiter und so fort.
Ja. Entschuldigen Sie bitte, die Dame war vor.
Nasta ist schon fertig.
Nein, sie ist nie da. Sie gehört ja dazu. Das ist alles schon klar.
Interessant ist, dass die amerikanischen Pragmatisten wie Dewey davon ausgehen, dass Demokratie immer eine Halluzination darstellt, dass sie gar nicht in solche Formen von Bildern gebracht werden kann. Also diese Form des Realismus ist schon Ausdruck eigentlich eines totalitären Systems.
Aber es ist kein Realismus überhaupt, das ist reine...
Das ist die innere Bestimmung des
Menschen. Nee, das ist eine reine Halluzination. Ja. Die sozialistische, Demokratie. Nicht die Demokratie, sondern der sozialistische Realismus hat mit Realismus nichts zu tun. Das ist eine äußere stilistische Fotografizität, die ja darüber täuschen soll, dass alle diese Bilder keine Realität entsprechen. Ja? Das ist,
genau,
das ist wie, da, ja, das ist so, so Pinsel wird benutzt wie Computer, sozusagen Computer, virtuelle Computerfotografie. Ja? Es geht darum, dass man sozusagen anscheinend Realität eine Imagination verleiht. Ja? Das ist so wie Surrealismus. Ne? 20er, 30er Jahre ist Surrealismus, magischer Realismus. Surrealismus ist eine Form, da sagen wir, kollektiven Surrealismus. Ja? Nicht auf der sexuellen Grundlage, sondern auf der Grundlage einer politischen Ekstase. Ja? Nicht erotische Ekstase, sondern politische Ekstase. Das ist sozusagen Surrealismus der politischen Ekstase.
Okay, vielen Dank.
мое несчастье, на мою беду. Я в саду хожу, хожу, да на цветы гляжу, гляжу. Но никак в цветах, цветах я милой не найду. Я милой не найду, ой, не найду.
Der Gang durch die Ausstellung Traumfabrik Kommunismus, die visuelle Kultur der Stalinzeit mit Svetlana Boym. Interessant ist, dass sie fast die ganze Zeit flüstert, so als würde Stalin ihr immer noch hinterher schauen, möglicherweise.
So, first we begin our tour by missing most important object here, which is a slogan, which says our goal is communism, which is exactly a Soviet slogan, but you have to read very carefully, it's signed Komar and Melamed instead of Lenin. So it was one of the early conceptual works, and the work of Komar and Melamed was actually part of the bulldozer exhibit. It was trashed during the bulldozer exhibit of 1972, after which they immigrated from the Soviet Union. So it was one of the most subversive works of the 1970s. Let me look at the date.
1972?
Is it 1972?
Yes.
So it's right at the time of the bulldozer exhibit. But what's important is if we're just passing through, we would see no difference between this work and the posters that we saw downstairs. So if this is an epigraph for the show, that gives it a very important kind of estranging look. But I think this would not be readable as an epigraph for a show unless you know and look carefully who signed Our Goal is Communism.
Okay.
So that is actually...
Take it and it's...
Well, this room, I think, is the most successful room in the exhibit because when I entered, my first impression is that I entered old Soviet museum. And usually I have an idea that this is a room I'm going to skip in the Soviet museum to look for something else. So in this exhibit, it really recreates the context of a Soviet museum with the lighting, the walls are not white, this ugly kind of brownish green color and the crimson. Right. So it almost feels to me like a Kabakov installation or something, because it's almost like an installation in the old Soviet museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say a few words about these works that you see here. They're very difficult to see. Since 1960s, socialist realism was virtually not exhibited in the Soviet Union. When I grew up, I no longer saw those works. Portrait of Stalin was virtually banned.
Yeah.
And to some extent, that was problematic because it wasn't like the heritage of Stalinism was dealt with. In fact, it was kind of buried and not dealt with. But for me, this is not my childhood. Yeah, I was born in 1959. This is the kind of the childhood of my parents, all the works I could not really see.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I would think that for organizers of this exhibit, the mere fact of showing this works is a way of confronting that kind of, I would not call it the factory of dreams, but more the background, the noise of the official culture that was there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I appreciate very much.
But we could look at the works and I didn't really...
Let's look at works. I know that in the early 1990s everybody became interested in socialist thrillism because it was not studied before, and it turned out that some people actually have a deep love for this kind of art. I never did. The only way I can look at that is through many, many lenses, you know, so many, many estranging techniques. Some people now are talking, well, it has interesting pictorial values because all this art is, you know, studied in the traditional academic manner.
Yeah.
It's a kind of Stalinist salon painting.
Yeah.
And I think the atmosphere here is of a Stalinist salon painting.
It's interesting how they work with light.
And of course, Boris probably told you how the depiction of Stalin figure is very important, but they often worked in early photographs, for instance, of Klutzes. It was very important that who is next to Stalin. It had almost pre-medieval iconography. It's almost like a Greek pyramid. So the artist could die by painting a wrong person next to Stalin.
Okay.
You know, Klutzes, the great designer and photographer who goes from constructivism to socialist realism, whose work we see at the very beginning in the cupola. He actually, you know, he was the one who embraced Stalinism after embracing constructivism. But there was somebody informed on him in 1937, so actually he was killed. He was a victim of purges, even though he was one of those responsible for kind of bringing together constructivism and culture of the 20s with the culture of the 30s. But there on his photo collages, you could see the beginning of this iconography, who is next to Stalin, because many of the images were cut and cropped, and in fact, the technique of photomontage was used as censorship, not so much as an avant-garde device.
Yeah.
So here it's very important that Stalin's working on the staircase just by himself.
Yeah.
He's the first, even though he's actually going down. But no symbolism, but it's very important who is in the second row.
Yeah.
And you almost see there is a space right around his head. It's almost like you could imagine there is like an aura or something, you know, like a saintly picture. So it's iconography comparable to icons and works like that.
And this one was Mao?
Stalin and Mao is in a famous song my father used to sing, Stalin and Mao are listening to us.
Really?
Stalin and Mao слушают нас. I'm not going to sing any. But also very important thing is how light works. Here you could see elements of impressionism, you know, even like orientalism, kind of impressionist orientalism, supposed to symbolize the friendship of people. But I'm sure that every, like on photographs, when they had pictures of Stalin, they would carefully clean up the road on which Stalin is working. So they would, it's pre-digital age, but they would clean up every speck. So here, the way that there are flowers was also very important. You also again see this empty space in front of Stalin.
Yeah.
He is, well, not the first, but there is like, he takes additional amount of space. So it's really is like a religious art.
Yeah, this is really famous.
This is a very, very famous image. Yeah, it's by Gerasimov, but there is a prehistory to this image because there was a photograph.
Yeah.
Which was multiply cropped because initially on the photograph Trotsky was next to Stalin. Lenin next. Trotsky next to Lenin. There is a book, and The Commissar Vanishes, that just came out in America, which shows you all the levels of how the image was cropped. So then there was Trotsky next to Lenin, then there was Sverdlov next to Trotsky. It was a huge problem. The workers were not represented in a correct way. So the photograph was cropped many, many times. Then the painting was done from the photograph.
On
the painting, of course, you see nobody in it. Next to Lenin, and you could hardly distinguish any faces of the people.
No.
But this was a safe representation. So you don't have to go
back. Okay.
This is the typical, you know, Stalin's version of Soviet feminism. You see Stalin and, you know, I don't know, this woman is some kind of heroine of labor or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And
but again, if you look at the other, there's Krupskaya, I think, Kalinin. Istanbul.
I think it's Lenin's wife, or?
Yeah, no, Krupska is Lenin's wife sitting there. But if you look at the flowers, you could just see how the painter used to be impressionist and perhaps studied somewhere some impressionist technique, and the only traces of that are left in the flowers around the edges. Yeah, this is like a film noir lighting. This looks to me more like a German painting. Doesn't that look like a German painting?
In a way, it's...
It almost uses this particular...
But the light is so real.
Yeah. And because you can never figure out what the source of light is. The source of light comes from great leader. It's not just from the sun. The source of light has to come also from inside, from the great leader, from the star represented here.
I think they are behind.
Oh, yeah. There is behind, yeah.
Starting walking. And this one was... This.
This also is a very iconographic image. There are photographs and documentary films, and Stalin is always doing this. And in many Soviet monuments, you could see exactly the same pose. And there is even a joke, you know, there was Stalin or there was Lenin with his hand outstretched. I don't know if he's showing a way to bright future or begging. But this image was very interestingly used in a documentary film by Semyon Aronovich, who took Stalinist chronicle and just kept repeating this image. And the element, it becomes very uncanny because it seems that Stalin is doing like warning you. He's showing you the way, but he's also warning you if you animate this image. But we don't have TV cameras. Somebody's dying. Okay, this is Gorky dying. Here, I've never even seen this. And this is Stalin by Gorky's bed. And of course, we know that, you know, Gorky and Kirov, who Kirov was killed in 1930s, Gorky died, they were hailed as great heroes. And of course, there are many stories about how Stalin actually orchestrated Kirov's murder, and they helped Gorky die quickly. Obviously, Gorky is a very important figure because in 1918, he was in opposition to the Bolsheviks because he believed in the General Assembly and so on. So he had this big debate with Lenin, after which he immigrated to Capri, but was persuaded to return back to Russia. And he was hailed as a founder of socialist realism and literature. Mm-hmm. So this is like the death of the founder. It kind of reminds me, I don't know if what it is, Marat, or some, which what's the famous French painting by David, somebody dying. Maybe it's Socrates. I forget it. Okay.
This one?
This is Vucetic. No, Shadra, I don't know who he is. It looks like a Vucetic picture.
Stone.
Well, this is interesting because it's really a transition between 1920s to 1930s. You see, it's almost like an expressionist image. So it still has this sort of Rodin-like elements on it. We don't know where he's throwing his, what he's throwing his stone into.
Yeah, that's right. Not on Stalin, maybe.
They're really mixing 1930s with 1950s. And this is Stalin at the deathbed of Zhdanov. And of course, the whole kind of deathbed scenario is quite interesting because we know that first Stalin's purges of 1930s, all the Leninists, you know, died and so on. But the whole kind of mourning ritual becomes perhaps very important. I've never seen so many mourning pictures before. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm telling you stories, but people who come on this exhibit, they have no context. So I don't know.
Only if they come to the exhibition.
Yeah. But if they come and see, I don't know how they look at those paintings.
But what would you say? How can we look really at this kind of? How are we looking on this?
I look at it as a kind of historic curiosity, because for me they don't longer have a magic value, and never really did, because I am of the 60s, 70s generation that perhaps was already somewhat of a cynical generation.
Yeah.
So perhaps if you talk with people older than me, it would be a different reaction. I do not take, these pictures for me do not have a magic aura.
Yeah, this one.
This is a fun one. This one I like very much.
Yeah.
This is called, of course, this is a juxtaposition.
Of it, to look at Stalin in a
Cameron Melamed.
Yeah. This is the one.
Yeah. See what
our goal is, communism.
Yeah. Yes, we see here the same thing. We have pictures from a statue from 1927, images from 1930s, from 1950s, and an image of conceptual art done.
It's 1981,
1982, when the artists, after their work were destroyed by the KGB during the bulldozer exhibit, famous, they immigrated, and they did a series called Nostalgic Socialist Realism in the United States.
But what is the meaning of this view?
What they did is they reacted to the kind of traditional alternative art that was mostly abstract. They decided to work like Warhol worked with advertisement culture, only differently, but use ideological images, also images of their childhood, kind of recycle them. And they paint in exactly the same manner, although sometimes they paint a little better. So they use the same pictorial language, but they use images that are slightly, there's a slight twist, something that would not be part of socialist iconography.
Mm-hmm.
So here it's almost like Stalin looking backwards. Mm-hmm. But there's Stalin alone. This could never be represented on socialist realist painting.
Mm-hmm.
But, and for me it's like a wink. It's a kind of reflective wink at the whole room.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's because I know the artists. I'm not sure it would be readable for other people. Can you tell me which other painting, looking from here, is by socialist realists and which one is by Cameron Melamed?
Maybe.
Let's see, guess. Academic manner.
Yeah.
But they almost push it to the degree of absurdity, because Stalin would never be represented as a muses. They do depict Stalin in this sort of neoclassical academic setting. Notice the green blue lining of his jacket. For that alone, you could die in this.
There's nothing on the board.
There is nothing in the book.
No inspiration.
What's important, it's a book. No, no inspiration. It doesn't need inspiration. There's light coming from it. But I think just for this blue, if this was painted in
this
the 30s,
this Madonna blue or...
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. But it's a very soft... And also you see like a bit of an Italian landscape down there. So it kind of reveals the quotational nature of the whole socialist realist. But it's very subtle.
Yeah, but would Stalin agree with this picture?
No, what I'm saying is that if it was painted in the 30s, the artists could go to jail for this. And in fact, Cameron Melamed in 1972 had to immigrate from their country.
Yeah.
So for me, I think I like juxtaposition pictorially, but it does not really tell you how different kind of art worked institutionally, that this was the official art mass reproduced in every magazine. Well, this was an art that could not even be shown in 1980s.
Mm.
In Russia. So when we see them on the same wall, it's true that they work within the same cultural mythology, but institutionally they work completely different.
He's a Lenin lamp.
It's not quite Lenin lamp. It's slightly better.
It's better, yeah.
It's more Italianate. It's more Italianate. You know, it's almost like they do go to the origins of socialist realism. There's this quotation from Italian landscape and the lamp.
Nostalgia.
But it's called from the serious nostalgic socialist realism, but it's not the same as nostalgia, because it's very much reflective. narrative about what it meant. It's not simply turning it into kitsch.
Yeah, not a but it's reflective thing in nostalgia.
Well, this is how I myself distinguish between two kinds of nostalgia. Restorative and reflective, and restorative nostalgia is based on nostos, or return home and reconstruction of home, while reflective nostalgia is based on longing and reflection on longing and time. So in my view, this is working with nostalgia. It's not simply turning it into a caricature, but it makes you reflect on how the nostalgia is made. It sort of lays bare the device, because you see all the quotations. You know, it's a little bit humorous. There is this blue of the dreams, Madonna blue. It's about, for the artist, these are images of their childhood. But it's also a reflection that if our childhood happened to be take place during totalitarianism, we have to reflect and distance it as well. So I think there is a relationship of...
So the wish is to have another free childhood, maybe. Another free childhood?
I think that's a... I don't know if one could have another free childhood. It's more that by painting it, you're almost exorcising those images that are no longer printed in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and you deal with them. You paint them yourself. You become an author of the image rather than the image. Mm. I think for an artist to paint Stalin, there is some element of exorcism in that, you know, and juxtapose it with muses. No, I think the image has both the irony and the pictorial affective relationship to this magic of the childhood. But if I would like do so, well, I think it's interesting if you look at it. If you look very carefully, this painting has a different frame. So that's a way of distinguishing it from the other images. I just noticed it. Thanks for you, because I was staying too long next to... See, both Comer and Melamed pictures have different frames.
Yeah, but...
So frames are the only things that can clearly distinguish them.
Yeah, and this picture is looking to the other picture.
Yeah, to some extent. Now I see subtle differentiating techniques.
Yeah, in which...
Like the frames and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
But again, I'm not sure that people who are not going to come... These are the only ones that are in black frames. All the socialist thrillers are in golden frames.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they borrowed it from Soviet museums, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they have the same frames. Okay. So we...
But I don't know this. This is a lot of these images are by Klutzes, the artist I described. I think this one is a photo montage by Klutzes.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them look like Klutzes, maybe. All of them. This is Klutzes too.
Mm-hmm.
See, here it's quite curious, because we have Klutzes, so it's 20s, 30s, kind of a move from avant-garde to socialist realism. We have a use of montage that originally was supposed to be the estranging technique that made you think about media and so on. Here montage used almost like a censorship to create ideological imagery. It's still interesting to look at. That still looks like, you know, this is what's appealing for all Western scholars of the avant-garde. They'll happily put images like that on the pictures of their books without any context. But we really see here how constructivist avant-garde devices are used for the ideology. There's no difference between this and how, you know, they're used now in advertising. And now if we look at this, this is Eric Bulatov.
Yeah.
Probably 1970s, my guess.
And what again, is the dangerous?
Dangerous, thing? dangerous.
What is dangerous?
Because you look at the year, 1972, I was exactly right. Eric Bulatov is also part of this Moscow conceptualism.
Like Melamed.
Comer and Melamed. And again, this is a very important year, 1971-72. It's the year of bulldozer exhibit. Because they used to exhibit. See, we don't know, we learn nothing about it, unfortunately, here. But this artist could never exhibit in the museums, so they exhibit in the apartments. It was like apartment art.
Yeah.
But in 1972 was a secret art in a way.
So it was dangerous to exhibit?
No, that's not about it. They're just using like a Soviet slogan, like, you know, danger, like what you could see in the streets of Frankfurt. But it's simply juxtaposing the slogan or some kind of street sign on the landscape. Mm-hmm. And also for Eric Bulatov, it's always very important to look at the horizon lights, like this welcome thing goes red, the horizon line, and you'd see in the other images the horizon light becomes red, and you know, because he is already seen some Malevich, and he's working with not in this painting, in later ones show you could see it. But I don't think danger is a direct reference about how this art was exhibited. It's just sort of look at this idyllic, socialist, realistic looking landscape, and they just put slogans like a ready-made.
I understand.
And gives you this sort of shock effect. It's also, look at the Red Square.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of using a little bit of avant-garde. It's rethinking 1920s.
It's realistic, but the realistic thing is the danger.
Yeah, it's no longer can be seen as mere illusionistic. Illusionistic art. Well, now it's actually interesting to think how these estranging devices are used in, you know, 20s to 30s. To, you know, the more I talk about it, the more it's all making sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is there for sure.
But what is this?
This could have been perfectly used. That's a good question. It's called Friendship of Peoples.
Yeah.
It's about the, you know, great communist friendship.
Okay.
But notice about great communist friendship. Of course, it's not ethnic, you know, xenophobia the way fascist art was. But the first figure is always Russian. Because Russians were first among equals. That's very important in the Soviet conception of nationality.
First.
Everybody was equal, but the Russians were first among equals.
Okay.
So little mix. And this guy is clearly the last among equals.
Looks like a ghost.
You know, it's like different people, you know. It's a worker, then there is a guy in a Red Army uniform and somebody in a Cossack or like Caucasian suit. It's kind of like the artist could not decide between national costume and the occupation. It's actually interesting in this respect because it's, you know, in early 1930s there's a great shift in Soviet politics. Before that, it was not ethnic at all. It was all based on classes.
Mm.
In early 1930s, Stalin introduces passports.
Mm-hmm.
So there is line nationality in the passport, which didn't exist before 1932.
Yeah.
And they are reinventing nationalism in 1930s. So they're reinventing national costumes and everything. So this painting, I think the painter couldn't decide between workers and soldiers and national costumes.
Okay.
We kind of put
that's
my interpretation. I don't know.
Because it's curious to have this.
Yeah, no, you know what? This is very early.
1923.
This is why he could not decide. So it's way before.
Because they had not a national.
It's really unclear, because you have like peasant or some kind of then Cossack. And these are like primitive people in the bath and the worker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of between, you know, Marx's idea that worker is leading peasants and all those primitive people.
But
they have a little bit of
structure.
Yeah. So it's a very early one. It's very early, so don't quote me, this is 1930.
Yeah, but it's interesting that there's no distinction of the nationalities or of the voluntarians.
Although some people are wearing something that looks like ethnic costumes.
Yeah.
You see the guy in a clearly Georgian or something. But they're led by a proletariat who is carrying the wheat. So he's carrying the symbol of peasants. But he's leading them.
Yeah.
It's almost like French Revolution too. You have this wheat which we used very much in French Revolution.
Yeah.
So it's still, you know, it couldn't decide on iconography.
Yeah. But this one
was Eric Bulatov. It's a good one. It's really good one. I think it's a really good one.
It's going down.
It's 1989. Yeah, it's there we saw the beginning of this hemicycle here. It's sort of again, look at the horizon light. line. It's all working with the communism, you know, the image of the future and the horizon.
But it's going down.
It's going down.
Yeah. And is it important?
It's a sunset. It's like in the Soviet joke. Do you know the Soviet joke?
No?
It would be hard to translate. To sit down, to sit in Russian means to be in prison, to sit in prison.
Oh, okay.
So one guy tells the other, oh, the sun has set. And the other guy says, well, that's really too much. Because the sun has set has a connotation, sun too is in prison.
Yeah.
So it's not doesn't translate well. But there are many jokes about sun setting. Mm-hmm. And then Brezhnev talks to this. Do you want me to tell you more jokes or not?
I asked Boris Kras, he told me a joke
about
sitting and thinking. Sitting, thinking. Yeah. This was
that's a very good one.
You have to ask him.
Yes, that's a really good one. The other one about the sun, Brezhnev talks to the sun, and the sun says, hello, comrade Brezhnev, in the morning. How are you? And Brezhnev says, I'm very good, comrade sun. I said, my great. I'm hailing you, comrade Brezhnev. And the sun says, thank you, comrade sun. And then everybody gathers like Politburo, and Brezhnev said, you treat me well. Even the sun is treating me really well and greets me every day. And the Politburo said, well, let's see. And, you know, Brezhnev says, comrade sun, it's in the evening, comrade sun. And the sun's like sitting down and screaming, fuck you, I'm already in the west. That's all. It's a stupid joke, but I think it's good for this painting. They're really okay. Stupid. But see, there's again the horizon line, which looks like Malevich.
Yeah.
So there's something interesting.
Yeah, here these are early Malevich. Yeah,
this is late Malevich.
This is late Malevich.
Early Malevich look alike, so your confusion is very appropriate.
Uh-huh. It's really...
Because this is really an interesting problem.
Yeah.
Because Malevich supposedly returns to representation in the 30s. Mm-hmm. I have a graduate student writing her thesis on that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very problematic return to representation. This is a very interesting painting.
It's kind of...
He also returns to painting peasants in Ukraine. He's originally from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And of course, 1930s is a time of this hunger in Ukraine,
which is
completely suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So the images are very problematic, but even more problematic is the fact that Malevich, am I talking too loud enough? Malevich painted non-representational paintings before suprematism. So often there are people who aren't sure about the dating, because like paintings from 1910 and from 1930 might look exactly alike.
Mm.
And sometimes Malevich reattributed his paintings.
Mm.
So it's an interesting issue here.
Yeah.
But this is a comment. I think very late Malevich was a lot of quote in Malevich in the sort of 20s-30s transition.
Yeah. No, the more I look at
what is a very... plus of this exhibit, what's very interesting is that we look at the artists that kind of fall between the cracks. They almost never show, like Labas, artists of 20s, 30s, who neither avant-garde nor the official socialist realism, but who experimenting with representation and doing some interesting work. Clearly this is not, you know, it's about transportation, sort of Soviet modernity. But it's not like official socialist realist images at all. I don't know much about the artist.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting dynamic painting. I think really, really excellent. It reminds me of Stieglitz photographs.
Mm-hmm. Is this social
dynamic
realist?
You know, this is this transitional moment. It's clearly painting workers and soldiers in this case.
Mm.
But I would not call it iconographic socialist realist painting.
Yeah, no, it's different. But it's very...
Thank you.
We see the image of Lenin, as we saw before, but incorporated into everyday context, in a way. We see it surrounded by that sort of ordinariness of everyday life. And this is 1960s, 1970s. It looks like a photograph, and Bulatov would take lots of photographs. And then he would like to paint it in a very unobvious way so it would not look grotesque or immediately ideological, but just ordinary. You know, it looks like a very non-posed photograph. Yet it also has a very precise geometric structure. That's what you would not guess, because he was interested in this avant-garde. You know, we have still the horizon line, Lenin sort of blocking the horizon line. And also you have three lines.
It's look like at a, this sort of, here's the sun sitting.
Yeah, he's sort of coming down, but also blocking the horizon line. And they're not facing him. He's showing them the way that way, and they're walking this way. But it's not a symbolic picture. What Bulatov tried to get this look of a very ordinary photograph, because it does not really look like a highly symbolic emblem. And I think, let's look at the dresses.
Yeah. It's sort of American.
Good on socialist realist paintings. It never rains.
Yeah.
Very important. And if you look at the ornaments in Moscow metro, I noticed once that you only see palm trees, you know, or bushes. It's as if the weather is only spring and summer. Winter has been forbidden.
That's only possible.
Almost similar to the colors we saw in the first. Because Kabakov always marks his spaces. The floor would be cracking. You go through the curtain, there would be a different sound. He always creates a sort of many frames around his space. And it's very important that this room is painted in a certain way. Have you noticed it?
Yeah, it's blue.
It's also very important because...
It's like the sky or
it's
like
It's not
water.
Like the sky. It's similar color, but this resembles many, many Soviet bureaucratic spaces. And Joseph Brodsky in his memoirs has a very interesting description, less than one, about the blue line. Like if you imagine this kind of coloring, but there would be like a line between white and blue. And Brodsky talks about this line that was in every building, be it prison, school, bureaucratic building. It's a kind of homogenization of any possible space. So I think for Kabakov, it also represents a sort of homogenized context, sort of Sovietness, graphic representation of Sovietness.
Should record a little bit of music.
You did already?
Yeah, I did, but I'm always feeling... very interesting.
Of Centre Pompidou. And then it made sense. It was like the whole Soviet world. And here we have a little snippet of it.
And there was music too?
Yes, there was a whole room with different images and music.
Mm-hmm. And what is...
I can sing you the songs. All Russians know this song.
Who is this?
Милый мой идет, на нем защитная гимнастерка, она с ума меня сведет. The song is, I'm in the collective farm and I see my darling coming back and he's in the military uniform and I'm just so hot for it. It's a positive feminist image, you know. This woman in colorful
Kabakov made this picture?
Yes, because Kabakov is very interested in painting this sort of average socialist realist art as if painted by untalented provincial socialist realist artist who didn't make it into the museum. So it's very important. He always does it himself. It's like a little museum of the untalented artist. It's very beautiful songs, though, yeah. But when I translate it to my American friends that it's my darling in his great military uniform, they get very upset with me.
it's having this, like this kind of Sehnsucht.
Yeah, exactly.
Dreaming. This is really a screaming dream factory.
And it's a chorus of women.
This is flowers on this...
And it goes up, why did you come to our collective farm? Why did you broke my peace of mind? These are the words. I should have sang it with Yulia for you. Remember we sang at that bar?
Yeah.
I already sang. Чем повстречала тебя на жизненном пути. This is my first recording.
Wow. But we have to look at the translations, because the translations are wrong. I don't know why. What's the reason for this translation? Ja, am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich jetzt Felicia Herrschaft. Das war der Gang durch die Ausstellung Traumfabrik Kommunismus, die noch bis zum 4. Januar in der Schirn laufen wird, mit eben jetzt dieser Gang durch die Ausstellung mit Svetlana Boym. Das Thema Kommunismus wird sich hier in diesen Sendungen noch fortsetzen, denn am 7. November zur nächsten Universalsendung wird es eine Vorabsendung geben zu dem internationalen Kulturkongress, der vom 7. bis 9. November in Frankfurt stattfinden wird, unter dem Titel Indeterminate Kommunismus. Und da hoffe ich dann endlich mit Žižek da tatsächlich ein paar der Fragen nach dem Begehren des Kommunismus zu diskutieren und ja, bis bald. Thank you.
Kinomagazin auf Radio X.
CinemaScope.
CinemaScope.